This is Marcus Whitney's Audio Universe.
Like, you gotta do the work. You gotta show up and just do the work.
Welcome back on a Wednesday. Marcus Whitney Live. Happy to see you all today and really thrilled to have my guest today. This is a good friend, and we've spent more time than normal together over the last couple of months because we're both launching books right in the same window of time. And he just launched his book yesterday. He is an accomplished CEO, former CEO and founder of InQuicker, also one of the former CEOs of the Nashville Entrepreneur Center, and blew me out of the water with this TEDx Nashville talk. He now has the most viewed TEDx Nashville talk in history. I'm talking about the one, the only, my good friend, Michael Brody Waite. Mike, what's going on, brother?
What's up, man? I'm like blushing over here, so thank you for that.
Yeah, man, it's great to have you on the show, man. How are you doing today?
Today, you know, we were talking about this before, like, I'm excited because the book's out. I'm excited to be talking to you. I'm also a little sad because this isn't what I thought it would look like when my book was going to come out. But I'm very grateful to, you know, be worrying about things like that in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's probably a great segue just to give the audience a let's maybe cap it at 5 minutes, but a great background on who you are. You have a fantastic backstory, very deserving of a TED talk. And I'm glad that you wrote this book. Certainly have been inspiring. One of the things I've loved about you is you've just always been, you've led with your truth, in every interaction that I've had with you and that you've had with the world broadly. So, say a little bit about yourself and then we'll definitely dig into your book.
Awesome. So at the age of 23, I was hopelessly addicted to alcohol and drugs. Every day when I got up, that was my obsession. I didn't care who I robbed. I didn't care who I hurt. I didn't care what happened to my body. I've been kicked out of school, kicked out of my job, kicked out of my house. My car had been repossessed. I was throwing up blood, and I wanted to OD and take myself out because I didn't see a way to recover. And then September 1st, 2002, I woke up at the Betty Ford Center in Rancho Mirage, California, a rehab facility, and I learned a different way to live. And that way to live is a way that I learned it through a 12-step program that addicts all around the world learn how to stop using. And that's not special. That's not different. But what I really have been obsessed with is, over the years, how can I take the principles that I learned in recovery and apply them to a unique place in my professional life as a leader? I spent 8 years in corporate America, working my way up from a kiosk rep in a mall to a corporate leader with 19 direct reports, with no college degree, with long hair, hoop earrings, and flip-flops from California in the South, trying to say y'all and butchering it like crazy. And one of the things I learned in building my career is I thought that practicing what I was taught in recovery would make me an outsider and hold me back from being successful. And it did one of those two things. It made me an outsider. Mm. It didn't hold me back from being successful. One of the things I distill this down to, which is very timely and interesting, is I believe that all leaders are taught that we have to wear a mask. Now, I've been saying this before the freaking pandemic. So I mean a figurative mask. I've actually had people be like, what are you saying? People shouldn't wear physical masks. And I'm like, no, dude. Like, I mean figurative masks. But like,
right.
Leaders for centuries have hid their true selves in the name of success, the same way drug addicts hide their true selves in the name of the next hit and the next high. But I think that truly great leaders learn how to do what I call living mask free. And that is something that there is only one segment of our society that has been rigorously trained on how to do this, and that is recovering addicts. And millions of addicts around the world have a process and system for living, leading mask-free. And I thought doing that in corporate America would make me a failure, and it made me the manager of the people that were my mentors. Mm. And it gave me a leg up, not because I was special, but because I was working a different set of principles that were counterintuitive at the time. And I left that job, and I realized that that was an advantage for me, and I co-founded InQuicker, launched a company I shouldn't have launched. We had no capital, we had no connections, we had no patents, we had no Ivy League degrees, we had nothing, man, but a credit card and a hope to reinvent access to healthcare. And we did that. And when looking back, the reason that we were successful is because we actually built a mask-free culture. We built a culture that was similar to the experience that I would have in my 12-step meetings. And so that's why I then did the TED Talk and wrote the book, because I realized that if people can take the principles that addicts have been using for 80 years to recover and apply them as a specific leadership system to live and lead mask-free, I think you can gain a competitive advantage. And one of the things I talk about is you can reclaim 500 hours a year just by living and leading mask-free in 1 minute a day using the system that addicts use to recover. And it feels like a secret weapon. And so now I'm on a mission to equip this, give everybody that's ever said, I can't show my true self to be successful in the work life. My mission is to equip them with not just hope and inspiration and the what and the why. There's a lot of people that do that. That's great. The actual how, like no matter what you execute this, you will be able to fulfill the value proposition. And so that's why I'm here today.
Why do you think that this way of living has only been taught in the rooms of alcoholics and drug addicts, addicts broadly? Why, you know, people who are practicing 12-step programs? Why do you think we know that those rooms don't have any demographic or even sort of psychographic, you know, or socioeconomic limits to them, right? They touch all ranges of humanity.
Addiction does not discriminate.
Right. You can end up in those rooms. So I think when that's the case, I just find it to be interesting, something that could be as universal as addiction. Why do you think that the principles and the practice have been limited to those rooms up until now?
I think that's a great question. No one's ever actually asked me that. So that's a great question. And I think that at the key, it's just necessity is a mother of all invention. And I think that I argue in my book that I see a lot of similarities between addicts hiding their true selves to get the next hit and leaders hiding their true selves to get the next successful milestone. And I think that leaders are actually addicted to their masks. And that's kind of what I argue. And so at the end of the day, one of the reasons that addicts use is because they want to hide themselves. And so we relate to the struggle. The problem is that when the leader hides himself, they get a promotion. When I hide myself as an addict, I get dead or locked up. And so we needed a more rigorous, like, I mean, anybody that knows me knows that, like, I'm a huge fanboy of Brené Brown, like, you know, worship her work. But when I read her book, it really pissed me off when I tried to get other people to practice it because they couldn't do it. And so there's a big difference between, hey, you should, you know, one of the things we talk about in recovery is if it was as simple as, hey, stop using, people would just stop using. I mean, right. If it was as simple as, oh, here's a book with some ideas on not using, people would just stop using. You need to have a step-by-step system. Any business knows this. You need to scale your core value proposition through process. Well, we needed the same thing to be able to live mask-free as recovering addicts, because if we don't come out into the light, we die in the darkness, and we just have a greater incentive than I think the rest of the world to figure out how to do that through a method.
That makes complete sense. Did you have anybody else that, you know, because addiction does not discriminate, we know that there are many, many very, very successful people in the world who are in recovery, right? That's not new information for us. Was there anybody that you sort of looked at when you were on your way in, a sponsor or otherwise, that, you know, sort of showed you, wow, this way of life can not only save my life, but it actually can lead me to have success out in the greater world, you know, in the material professional world? Did that connection happen for you?
Yes and no. So I was told that, so I think sponsors are the greatest leaders in the world, and they lead differently than any other leader. They lead only through their experience, and they use actually their failures more to show you how they lead themselves than they do to actually talk about their successes, right? And it's just a very different way to lead. And so my first sponsor's name was Chuck. He's in the book. And I talk about a time where, you know, I looked up to him and I thought he let me down. He's like, dude, if you put me up on a pedestal, I'm going to fall right the heck off. Like, yeah. Like, what are you doing? I told you this. And so I think that what he shared with me was, I could do anything. I could be anything if I could stay clean. And so he showed me how to lead myself and that I could fulfill my potential. But what I will say, which is why I'm so passionate about the work I'm doing, nobody ever told me that it would go into a specific segment of my life, my professional life. And instead of being a stigma, it would be a superpower. No one told me that.
Right.
No one told me, like, as an addict, we're taught, hey, work a program so you neutralize the negative. No one told me, like, when I do my thanks in the morning, I thank God for my addiction before I ever start talking about
it
my
would
recovery.
Go into. Yeah.
So the thing for me is that at the end of the day, no one told me this. There was no model for me that being an addict is better than not being an addict when it comes to getting dedicated to a process of recovery and having to practice that and having gaining a professional advantage. And so that's why I want to shine that light. He gave me a general promise, but I wanted to make a specific promise.
Yep. That makes so much sense. So I think that is probably a really good point to shift into your book that just launched yesterday. So congratulations.
Yeah, thanks, man.
You know, we both are crossing the threshold of being authors, and it's definitely a path you have to earn, for sure. There's nothing easy about navigating the process of getting your thoughts down into however many words, you know, your book or my book are. You know, talk to us about what this book delivers.
Before I do that, I want to talk about what Marcus Whitney delivers. Before I was writing this book, you were working on yours and you were inspiring me. And I remember asking you, how did you get through the writer's block? Because that was something that was really hurting me. And you gave me a great piece of wisdom that someone else gave you. And you said, you have to write a couple of bad books before you write the good one. And you said that to me in the boardroom at the EC. I'll never forget it. And that was something that I carried with me throughout this entire process. So I want to tell you that you've helped me in this journey. So this book essentially takes all my frustrations with people talking about authentic leadership and us not having authentic leaders. I mean, when was the last time you heard a politician answer a question with, I don't know?
Oh,
like,
man.
Never.
That's a different show.
that's a whole can of worms too. So what the book delivers is a step-by-step system that allows you to take the three principles that I learned in recovery and apply them by creating a mask-free action card that you only have to execute in 1 minute a day. And if you do that, and it's a step-by-step system, you don't need to think about anything. If you do that, you will reclaim 500 hours a year. And so people think that's outlandish. Well, one of the things I talk about in the book is that there are four masks that are holding back every individual, team, and organization in this world. And the first mask is saying yes when you could say no. We spend 31 hours a month in meetings that are unnecessary alone. The second mask is hiding a weakness. When I was in corporate America, I spent 22 hours trying to figure out how to do a pivot table in Microsoft Excel when I could have spent 10 minutes asking someone for help. The third one is avoiding difficult conversations, not asking for what we need from our boss for resources, or not negotiating the contract with a customer or performance managing an employee. And the fourth one is holding back your unique perspective. We've all been in a room with 50 people and all 50 brains weren't activated. Only the person at the top spoke about the blind spots or the potential innovations, and time is lost in those areas. And those four masks, 90% of leaders say that they wear at work. So what we do is we take them through a process where they identify which mask is holding them back, and then we apply the system of the principles that I learned in recovery to give them a step-by-step process to take that mask off.
Man, I feel like I'm going to save 500 hours this year just from having listened to you over the last 1 minute. That's incredible that you were able to distill those principles into quantitative, story-based tips for people. That's really straightforward, and they're definitely four things that everybody either has struggled with or currently does struggle with. You know, like they may have sort of figured out one or two of them, but those four combined, you're absolutely right. They're massive time wasters, and they also like sell you short. You know, that's sort of the other thing that I think is really interesting. They sell you short from what you're capable of achieving. So, wow, that's incredible. Have you tested out this model with other people?
Yeah, that's how I arrived at it. Because what I used to do is I would like a company would hire me to come speak to them after they saw my TED talk, and I would just be like, "Hey, dude, you should do what drug addicts do," and then like tell them about like crazy stories and like expect the change to happen. So this has been something I've been working on for 3 years. I started working on it a year before I did the TED talk. The TED talk was one of the manifestations of the work. So I've assessed over 1,000 leaders. So from the boardroom to the mailroom to the classroom to the living room. Large companies, small companies. I've worked with companies like Google and Global Payments and Dell and startups and nonprofits. And I created this mask assessment that gives you the authenticity percentage that you have. And then I really started asking a bunch of behaviors. And the assessment used to actually be really complex because I thought I had to be complex to deliver value. And over time, I started to realize as I started coaching people and doing workshops and speaking that you could actually, through these assessments, I think by the time I started assessing 500 people, I was like, crap, there are only 4 masks.
Wow.
And you know, Don Miguel Ruiz wrote the 4 Agreements, and then 10 years later, he came out with a book called The 5th Agreement. So I might find the 5th mask somewhere. I'm not perfect. But as I started working with people, I realized that, wow, I can consolidate this all down to 4 masks. And so what we did was we just isolated that, refined the assessment, and tested the model and gave it to executives at corporations, owners of companies, entrepreneurs, like whoever. And the thing is that now we've done it for 1,000 people, and they say that they resonate with the results, and it creates action. One of the things that we were taught in recovery is action over insight. We spend a lot of time thinking and talking, man.
Amen,
but
man.
Action is a great curator. And so that's what I really love about recovery. So what we've really done is we've simplified it so that people can just take that assessment and just get off running. I mean, we all wear those 4 masks at different times. Some of us struggle with more than others.
So to that end, let's start talking about what we're all experiencing today. But I want to go back to something you started this whole conversation with, which is you've worked on this project for years now. You know, you've put in the work. You've done what was necessary to make something that was going to really have a large impact in the world. And then, you know, a pandemic occurred. A once-in-a-lifetime event occurred. And the timing is such that we are in the thick of it right as your book launch has arrived. What has that been like for you? And how have you processed that and used your own process to be authentic in this moment? I mean, you know, you gave a good example of that in the very beginning, just talking about some of the disappointment and sadness around the fact that the launch didn't end up what you thought it would be. But, you know, there's always sort of that. And then there's also coming on the other side of that grief and that mourning and realizing, you know, the greater opportunity that, you know, is a gift in that moment. Can you talk a little bit about like just what experiences, feelings you've had through this process?
Yeah. So there's a lot of parallels between this process and actually drug addiction. So I told you that where I am now is I arrogantly believe that God created the pandemic just for my benefit.
I didn't know if you were going to say that again. You are mask free for real, man.
And I'm not lacking sensitivity to the challenges for everybody. I'm impacted too. But I'm on the other side. And one of the things that addicts do is we turn crap into fertilizer. And the thing about a pandemic is now everybody knows what it's like to be an addict. We all are being impacted by a disease that is outside of our control, that is isolating us and changing our lives. And so for me, I have practice in this. At the same time, I had never applied it to a situation like this. Mm-hmm. And so in early March was going to be the beginning of our promotion window for the book. And I've invested a significant amount of the money that I made from selling my company. I've got a lot of stuff on the line. I got employees. I got all this stuff. It's also my purpose and my mission and something I've been dreaming for years. And right when the promotion window was going to start, that was the week that COVID became real, when the NBA season got suspended. Also, I'm going to share this here, but there was an A-list celebrity that saw my TED Talk that wanted to help me promote my book, and then they were one of the first people that got COVID.
Wow.
And I was actually supposed to go visit them, and they were going to help me promote it, and then their entire life was different. And so I was like kind of going, wow, this is a different world. And then I get on a call with my team and my PR firm, and they're like, okay, all the earned media that we lined up is all gone. We can't even get, you know, coverage on the election,
yeah,
let alone your book. And so I was like, oh man, like the promotion window's gone. And then that weekend, my wife became sick. And then within 3 days I was sick. And due to the spectrum of the symptoms that we had, and a friend of ours, it's a healthcare provider, we were very fortunate that our lives were not threatened, but we both came down with COVID. And I found myself wearing a mask with my team. Mm. We would be on a call and I'd be like, oh, it's gonna be fine, we're gonna work through this, blah, blah, blah. And meanwhile, I was like trying to be positive, but I didn't fully understand what was going on because I was cognitively impaired. And I remember being on a walk with my wife where it just hit me all at once. I was like, oh shit, I didn't think about this. All of our revenue was based on speaking engagements for this year. I was planning on reinvesting everything from the book. And so not only are we not gonna get earned media to get the book out there that was supposed to drive speaking engagements, all the speaking engagements that we had booked are gonna be gone. All of our revenue is zero. I didn't realize that. And I felt like a fool because it took me time to realize that. But when I realized it, I immediately started applying the three principles that I teach in my book. So practicing rigorous authenticity is identifying the mask on your face and identifying which one of those four you're dealing with. And I was hiding a weakness. I, as the leader, the CEO, the leader of InQuicker, the leader of the EC, the leader of the mask-free movement, whatever, the author of the book, I didn't know what to do. And I was hiding that. And so I was like, okay, all right, principle number two, surrender the outcome. That is the biggest principle that everybody struggles with. We are taught to obsess over outcomes, right? But we learn in recovery, and what I teach in this book is surrendering the outcome is a step-by-step process that you can do to reclaim a massive amount of energy. And so for me, it's identifying what's the outcome I'm scared of. I'm scared that the book won't be successful, won't make an impact. I'll have to fire my employees, I'll have to sell my house, and I'll have risked everything. And my biggest fear is I always teach all fears come down to physical death or social death. My physical death fear was I wouldn't be able to provide for my family. My social death fear was that I was a fool for pursuing my passion.
Wow.
And that anybody that was like, that was stupid, great leaders live like drug addicts, who the hell do you think you are? They would be able to say, I told you so. And so I had to identify that outcome. And the way that we overcome that is we split everything down into what I can't control and what I can control and start listing things out. And it's literally on this card. I feel like it's the stupidest tool ever because it's so simple. It's literally you write it out. But I started writing out what I couldn't control. And I realized I can't control what's going on outside. I can't control that I was sick. I can't control any of this stuff. I can control whether I completely redo my financial model to understand if I can keep employees, to understand if I can make the mortgage, to understand what can I do to actually get this book in people's hands to make an impact. And shifting from can't control to can control, one of the things that I talk about is if you can get rid of everything that you can't control and you focus exclusively on your can't control, you reclaim so much energy that you start identifying uncomfortable work that you have not been willing to do.
Wow.
And I found my uncomfortable work, and you're going to laugh at this, and it's stupid in some ways. Building this movement, I had been thinking about building it through the lens of scale. Because I built a software company and then I helped software companies build.
Yep.
And so I wasn't teaching people this process once I started promoting the book.
Yep.
I wasn't actually executing what was in my freaking book.
I get it. I get it, man.
I started executing it. And then you know what? Less people are going to buy the book this week and more people's lives are going to be impacted because I actually started doing it. And that was my uncomfortable work because I was so scared of actually helping people and then being scared of having so many people that wanted help that I couldn't scale and do it. I stopped that. I just started helping people. And I swear it turned the frown upside down. Opportunities started showing up. I can't believe I just said frown upside down. opportunities started showing up. And now, like, I see a future for an even stronger movement. I see a future for doing virtual speaking so that I don't have to be away from my family. I see all these wonderful opportunities, but I had to go through the process myself. And even recently, one of my employees was like, you know, I waited 2 weeks for you to tell me what we were going to do. I wish you had just told me that you were working on it. You didn't know.
Wow.
Because I'm trying to plan for my personal finances and I'm reading the news while you're trying to work it out.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, dude, this stuff is real and I got to do it. So that's recent.
Holy cow, man. That is a lot. That is a lot. I feel a lot of what you just said. Can we just dig into one thing that you breezed past, but I want to drill down into, which sure. is a bit of the survivor's guilt stuff.
Yes.
Cause that's in there. You know, you talked a lot about the loss, but also we're all dealing with relative levels of loss. Right.
Yep.
And I think those of us who still have homes and haven't missed meals and, you know, are fortunate enough to even be able to launch a book, even if it's not the ideal environment for us, right? You know what I mean? There's something weird about all this, right? There's something weird about being able to do this when you know so many other people are affected at much more fundamental levels. And, you know, we're talking about physical death or social death, you know, just in terms of like food, clothing, shelter stuff. Right.
Yep.
You know, how has it been for you processing that and how do you associate that in the four mask paradigm?
Yeah. So basically I have two different filters that I'm wearing at the same time. The first one is I'm grateful that I have clean food, clean water, clean air, and shelter. Like, I'm grateful for that. And I know that anything above that is gravy. I also know I'm supposed to be dead by 30 and I'm 41. So I'm playing with house money. So I can always go to that place and go, you know what? I'm lucky. At the same time, pain is relative. And I had an expectation. I don't have to worry as much about the things I worried about when I was on the street using. And I had this thing I poured all this time into, and I had to deal with the loss of it not working the way that I thought. And one of the really cool things about survivor's guilt, or not cool thing, but I have a lot of experience with survivor's guilt, because any one of us that are in recovery, for every one of us, there's probably 10 other people that aren't. And so I remember even talking about getting a job at Dell or starting my company, I felt guilt talking about that around my friends in recovery, especially the ones that were just in off the street, the ones that had to get their sheet signed to stay out of jail, like whatever it is. And so I've really had to learn that I can have both filters at the same time. And in the four masks, I think it comes down to unique perspective. I think that those of us that are fortunate enough to worry about things that are greater than shelter, food, and water, and health. I think that for me, at least, I feel the fear of talking about this stuff. I feel the fear of what people will think, that I'm not towing the party line on the reality, and I'll be called out for X, Y, and Z. But pain is relative. It's a real thing. It's why you see successful athletes or CEOs take themselves out. They have everything that, you know, they you'll want in the world, but they take themselves out. We see all kinds of stuff. And so I think for me going through this, you know, I have a lot of friends in recovery that aren't worried about a book. They're worried about a job. They're worried about a paycheck. They're worried about unemployment. And one of the really cool things about talking to them is my buddy Toby, he's sitting there going on unemployment, worried about all this stuff, but he's still supporting me through my loss of, or my challenges of how do I deal with this pandemic as it relates to the book, because we both know it goes unsaid, but we both know that we're both just lucky to be having this conversation. And I think as long as we can have empathy for both our past selves, that's grateful for the basics that we have in our life today and for what everybody else is going through, I think that at the same time, I should be able to have hold up my unique perspective and talk about the more advanced challenges that I'm lucky enough to have, because I'm not the only one going through them.
Dude, thank you for sharing that. That's been one of the underlying difficulties for me over really this entire time. It was very clear to me early on that this was going to be devastating at an economic level. I knew I was just as vulnerable as anybody else was, at least in the beginning on the health side of things, when it wasn't sure, you know, wasn't sure if I was exposed to it. But economically, you know, I knew it was a timing issue. You know, for me, one of the things that was most clear about that was I'm on the board of the Nashville Convention Visitors Corporation, and we had a board meeting, and we were sort of running through the numbers of how much this had impacted the hospitality industry. And, you know, Mike, 20 years ago when I moved here, I waited tables. That was, you know, that was the free market safety net that is responsible for Marcus Whitney. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like if that wasn't there, I don't know what happens to me. And, you know, quite frankly, this is just a matter of timing. I'm just 20 years lucky. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's a great way to look at it.
Yeah. When I hear about the numbers and the devastation, I do have a sense of guilt. So, you know, your perspective was super helpful to me. So thank you for that, man.
Yeah.
All right, that's all the time we have for today. Where can people find your book? I'm going to promote your socials, but where can people find your book?
Greatleaderbook.com or in all the major retailers.
Awesome. Go out there, get this book, support this incredible human being, good friend of mine. Mike, thanks for being here and doing the show. You can find Michael everywhere online. Michael Brodywaite, Mike Brodywaite. Here's all his socials. So check this guy out, follow him, support him. His mission is really, really important and I think can help a lot of people. As always, please subscribe to my podcast. If you think about it, you can find me on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, on and on and on. And of course, thank you for watching the show, whether you're catching it on the replay or you're watching it live. I appreciate you. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, even Twitch now, which I don't have up here. But definitely appreciate your time, your energy. It means a lot to me that you're spending time with us here today. And I look forward to seeing you tomorrow for yet another episode of Marcus Whitney Live. Until then, let's build a new normal, y'all. Peace.
Thank you for tuning in to Marcus Whitney's Audio Universe.